So the first question, it looks like it's in two parts. So ACA was passed with 60 votes in 2010. All were Democrats. I believe this was done due to the filibuster issue. Well, the ACA was kind of passed in two parts. And one part was passed with 60 votes in the Senate, and then the remainder was passed via reconciliation. Actually, because of reconciliation, the House wasn't able to amend the Senate version that was passed with 60 votes and had to just use limited versions that were subject to reconciliation. The next question is, if a budget is passed and you wrote the budget is not subject to the filibuster, can the appropriations be subject to the filibuster to recover items the budget leaves out? Yes, appropriations bills are subject to filibuster. So while Republicans control the House, Senate, and White House, if the Democrats in the Senate, if eight of them don't join the Republicans to allow a bill to proceed to a vote, that could force a shutdown, even if Republicans would likely take the blame for it. It's probably both their failure to negotiate. So potentially, I mean, if the budget caps come and are a lot lower on the Republican side than what Democrats are willing to live with, then yes, they could filibuster the appropriations bills. The next question is, can existing retired federal government pensions be reduced, or are we only talking about future retirees? There are different ways that legally your federal retirement annuities could be reduced over what they would be now. You know, the most prominent proposal that has occurred has been changes to the cost of living adjustments. They probably, I think constitutionally there are some limits on just totally getting rid of them. But certainly there's room to change things like your cost of living adjustment. However, we have not seen any proposal in that regard recently. The most recent proposal has been the chain CPI, which would lower the cost of living adjustments going forward, not simply eliminate them. That has not received that much attention recently, but if it does receive more attention in the future, that's certainly going to rise to the top of our list of priorities to oppose. In terms of the $50,000 over 10 years for FEHB premiums rising, the question is this the cumulative additional cost? Yes, this is the cumulative additional cost of the premiums, not the total amount of premiums. Sorry if that was not clear. Next question is, okay, in July 2015, the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board approved TSP participants greater flexibility in withdrawing their funds from TSP in order to increase incentives to stay in TSP after retiring. This action would take effect in the next few years and be the most impactful since it calls for a legislative change. We are now in 2017, and it's very important to me to know the status. Unfortunately, this is from an article in the NARF magazine from April 2016. The board is supportive of it. The Employee Thrift Advisory Council, of which NARF is a member, has supported this legislative change, but it needs congressional approval. We do not have a bill at the moment to do so. I think the Thrift Board is a little wary of any bill having something negative tied to it, but it's something we still want to pursue and push and support to have flexible withdrawal options. Next question is, regarding the $50,000 proposed increase in health insurance premiums after 10 years, my current retirement benefits $43,000 per year. Interesting dilemma. Sorry if it wasn't clear. The $50,000 would be the cumulative loss you would have over 10 years, but the increase would be significant and be in the thousands of dollars per year increase in your health insurance costs, depending on if you're self or self plus one. The question is, I thought I heard at the legislative training conference that the reconciliation process can only be used once or twice a year. Is that correct? Yes, there are limited bites at the apple, if you will, for the reconciliation process. for 17, generally it's one time. There can be done a couple times a year. So for 17, there was an attempt to bring a bill to the floor on the Affordable Care Act replacement and repeal. That, because it didn't get to the floor and didn't go through the process, that is still potentially open to amend to use for 17. The second one would be used as part of the 18 budget process. So, yeah, there are limited bites of the apple on reconciliation. If tax reform is used in 18 and our issues are not involved in that tax reform bill, we would, you know, likely to be safe from hits. Next question is, how often should you send the letters that are on the LA Legislative Action Center monthly? Yeah, if you've sent one letter, you don't need to send it too many other times. Maybe another call to check in on where it is. But they should be, your congressional office should be tracking the correspondence. So I think it's about if you've sent the letter, I think it's about encouraging other NARF members to send the letter too. Next question is, can any changes be made with federal benefits just through executive orders? There's very limited changes that can be made through executive orders. There are federal benefits programs, like the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program is administered by the Office of Personnel, Office of Personnel Management, which does report to the president. So certain things could change there, but a lot of that program is set in statute. For example, the amount by which the government contributes to your premiums. So things can change, but nothing really essential to the benefits can be changed through just executive action. The next question is a question about the current status of H.R. 1251, the CPIE Act. It has been introduced and it has a number of co-sponsors. I do not know the total off the top of my head, but it also has been referred to committee. We don't expect any action anytime soon on that bill, though we certainly support it and were there at the press conference in which it was introduced. Question is, NARF is a member of a grand alliance to save our postal service along with APWU, NALC, the National Postal, so the Postal Workers Union, the Letter Carriers, the Postal Mail Handlers Union, and the National Rural Letter Carriers Association. Has NARF reached out to the four postal unions? I'm an APWU retiree. And what has their response been? We have basically been told we need this bill passed and that retirees will just have to take a hit. And the unions, all of them, strongly urge passage of H.R. 756. So, yes, we are certainly in contact with all of those groups. We are part of the Federal Postal Coalition. I know all of their main lobbyists personally. We have a honest disagreement on this bill. They've kind of made a compromise that I think works for them and for current employees and for some retirees who won't be affected. But we certainly object on the grounds that I outlined. I think they would be supportive of some fix if it didn't mess up the bill. Unfortunately, a lot of the financing for the bill comes through shifting costs of Medicare and postal retirees. And so we're certainly always open to working with them on compromises that address our concerns. We'll be working with them on other issues as they arise that are outside of this postal reform bill. And we support certain provisions of the bill that they support, like six-day delivery, maintenance of service standards, to-the-door delivery. But again, we have an honest disagreement on the issue regarding whether this is necessary for this bill. Next question. What are the odds of the above being implemented? I don't know what the above refers to. Next question is, are you expecting a continuing resolution for FY17? I think it's very possible, but it's also possible that there's some type of omnibus appropriations bill. I think Congress was potentially ready to pass appropriations bills into December, or they were close to it. A lot of the work of the appropriations committees had been done by then, and I think strategically with a new president coming in and Republicans controlling all of Congress, they were waiting to see what the presidential priorities were. At this point in time, it could just be a CR because they can't get agreement, or it could be a more specific appropriations. Next question is, what is more effective, phone call or personalized letter? I would say a phone call a little bit more. Seems to take a little bit more effort to do, so gets a little bit more of an effect. Personalized letter is great as well, if that's all you can do. But I think if you can do the phone call, that's wonderful. I have a couple questions on reviewing your submissions via the Legislative Action Center. Please follow up with leg@narf.org. I don't know the exact logistics of those. Somebody else might have a better idea, or I could figure it out for you. Question is, how can we oppose HR 756 when the ranking committee member is a sponsor? We are not the ranking committee member. We can certainly ask the ranking committee member, or let them know, him know, that we have concerns and try to change the bill as it goes forward to the House floor. And that's still an effort we plan to undertake. Next question is, it sounds as though the G Fund will be rated to finance whatever. Is this correct? Well, hopefully if we do our jobs advocating against that proposal, it will not be correct. But that proposal has popped up as a pay for other priorities. We will see. We think that's just a really dumb proposal on the G Fund. And certainly if it happened, we would advise people to move their money out of to the G Fund before, because it would be a worthless investment. But yeah, hopefully that's not going to come true. Other question, any hope at all for a GPO WEP repeal or at least reduction / lower penalty? I think there is a little hope, but not at the moment. Not for repeal, but for potentially reform. The chairman and ranking member of the House Committee on Ways and Means have had a bill that would reform WEP. This would not apply to GPO, unfortunately, and we still support reform or repeal of that as well. But for WEP, they have not reintroduced that bill, not because they don't support it, but because they are now starting the session as chair and ranking member. And usually a chairman doesn't introduce a bill until they're closer to ready to work on it and move it forward. So given that the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee has been busy with repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act and tax reform, we really need to get past those two things before he's going to be ready to focus on that. We will, of course, periodically check in with his staff just to see where things are and see how we can be helpful. But he's got no intention to move it anytime soon. It's just not ripe yet. But we're hopeful that whether it's later this year or next year, that we can get back on an effort to try to reform WEP. But we will see. Question is, if my representative agrees with my views, should I contact him or send a letter? Absolutely. Especially if you can be specific and point to something specific that your representative has done, thank that person for doing what you like them to do. It certainly helps to have that encouragement and let them know and reinforce good behavior and make sure that that's a priority for them. The next question is, has anyone submitted legislative changes to the Poultry Reform Bill to make the changes optional? No, not yet. Last year in July, when the bill was marked up, there was an amendment offered by Representative Lawrence to provide an opt-out for current postal retirees. So automatically, they would be automatically enrolled in Medicare, but they would have this option to not take, to kind of opt out. That amendment was then withdrawn and wasn't voted on. This time around, Representative Lawrence was brought on board to the bill by the other members of the committee and did not offer it. And so she is no longer supportive of that position, unfortunately. Next question is, do you think the postal reform bill will pass? I think it has a good chance. It has a lot of people backing it, and it's not often you see a normally very partisan oversight and government reform committee in the House have bipartisan action, and it has on this. So we are fighting an uphill battle on this. Again, we do not want to block final passage if we can fix the provisions we oppose, but we're certainly concerned about it. Next question. Other than changes to FHBP and proposed postal Medicare mandate, is there any other talk about changing current retiree pensions benefits? Not really. Again, there's a few other proposals that might pop up. Change CPI is one, which would lower your cost of living adjustments. But there hasn't been anything else specific on current retiree pensions and benefits. But the FHBP cuts would be the one thing that we're focused on. The next question is, how many postal retirees are there now that could be impacted and set a precedent? 76,000 this provision would apply to, and it would, for those just 76,000, it would be a cost of over $1 billion over 10 years. Next question is, what kinds of challenges to federal benefits do you expect other than the challenge to the cost of FHBP premiums and retirement contributions? Are other changes to retirement rules likely? There are possibilities. I think the next biggest possibility would be some changes for future hires, maybe just eliminating the FERS benefit altogether for future hires, along with some transition for current employees to a different, to just a TSP type system. So there are some other proposals out there. There were other ones in the budget resolution that were smaller, or things that have been floated, such as, you know, high three to high five, or ending the FERS annuity supplement. Most of those would be just for, you know, people who are not vested, future employees, essentially. But we never know until we see the actual language. So there are, there's a whole host of kind of transitioning out of any defined benefit system proposed by the Heritage Foundation, which has had influence in the administration, so and has influence in Congress. So we'll see. There might be other ones out there. These are the ones that we're most keenly keeping our eye on right now. I've asked that it's possible Congress will pass a CR for the remainder of 2017. I've answered that before. Question is about online reports of a meeting with a member of Congress or the staff of the member having some trouble. We will look into that for you and make sure that is up and running. We have had reports in on other members' meetings, so I will touch base on that, though. There's a question of why the GPO WEP bill was not shown in the April magazine tracker. Is NARF think full repeal is unlikely? Yes, we do think full repeal is unlikely. I think the reason why it wouldn't be in the April NARF magazine tracker is that it was probably introduced after that went to print and press. I would have to double check on that, but I'm sure that bill and the CPI bill will be in the magazine track, or are in the most recent magazine trackers that are going out. But we always have the April magazine, for example, will be sent out at the end of March, and the deadline for it is probably in the beginning of February, and it doesn't get finalized until, you know, is still finalized prior to March. So with some of our print deadlines affect when bills go in the tracker. Another question about efforts to reduce WEP. I've mentioned that before, that there is a chance that there would be a WEP reform bill similar to what we saw last year in H.R. 711 going forward. But right now, that committee and the chairman of that committee, who is the sponsor of the bill, is focused on tax reform, potentially healthcare reform. Another question that says, I've heard this on TV yesterday. What voice do we in the field really have? Congressional districts have been so gerrymandered that representatives choose the voters, not the other way around. I think gerrymandering is an issue but it doesn't mean that if you live in the district that you still don't have a voice. I mean, it might be that you might be in a district in your state that is gerrymandered so that the person you like is your member of Congress. And if you're voting for that person, you certainly have a voice because they care about whether, the people who are their traditional voters will be happy with them. If you're not, then, they're still your member of Congress and their job is still to represent you. So I don't think that should mean you give up. Next question is, NARF also opposed the Postal Service mandating Medicare Part B for current employees when they retire and turn 65. We do not support that for current employees, but we've also are not going to try to oppose an entire bill and hold it up based on opposition for current employees, given that all the employee unions and management groups are okay with that trade-off for the other provisions of the bill. So not supportive, but we're really opposing the bill based on what it does for current retirees. Question about, will there be buyouts this fiscal year? I do not know. That's generally an agency-by-agency decision. Will very likely be determined by what happens in the appropriations process for programs and where the spending goes, and if there needs to be reductions in force, and if buyouts are one way to do that. So we will see. Next question is, what is happening with the usage of TSP G Fund for government funding? This is still going on. I think this question is referring to when the debt ceiling has been reached, the Treasury uses certain extraordinary measures to prevent the government from defaulting on its debt. It's a way of shifting money around internally. Its biggest extraordinary measure is suspending daily reinvestments in the G Fund. This does not impact individuals who have accounts in the G Fund from taking money out or shifting it between TSP funds. And it is paid back routinely once the government reauthorizes an extension of the debt limit. But this is occurring now because the debt ceiling has been reached, and we do not support it. We also do not want people to take their money out of the G Fund or change their retirement investment decisions based on this, because there's been a long history of the Treasury reimbursing and making whole, and the statutory language requires it. So while they can do this temporarily, they are not allowed to do it permanently. Another question is asking about if there's a way to compromise on the postal reform to require Medicare enrollment by current retirees as FEHBP begins to offer plans tailored to the situation, such as Aetna Direct. The premiums for the combination may be about the same monthly cost or higher than non-Medicare tailored plans. Hopefully more plans will be offered that recognize Medicare enrollment and thus save money on FEHBP premiums. It's a good question. We've floated some of those proposals around before, in terms of having a premium discount or refund for retirees based on their Part B enrollment, but have not gotten support from others on that. It's something that we might, explore. I think one of the issues is that something like Aetna Direct may not occur for postal retirees once this bill goes through. The reason why is because the premium reimbursement that Aetna Direct provides to federal retirees right now is sort of an incentive to enroll in Medicare or to bring people into their plan that have Medicare. If everybody is already required to enroll in Medicare Part B, there's less of an incentive for that to be offered for those individuals. So I think the idea is a good one, some type of premium reimbursement or subsidy for the Part B because it picks up more costs. It's something we could see, but has not been accepted yet either. Next question was that APOW does not, where did we go? Okay, so next question was that APOW does not oppose HR 756, so where does that leave us with the postal employees on the Medicare issue? Look, I've had this conversation with postal employee unions, whether it's President Diemenstein has been in with President Thyssen to talk about this. We've talked to our current counterparts with those unions. We've talked to members and explained our position. I think postal employee and retiree members understand the position, and we're happy to justify it to them. And we have an honest disagreement with the groups. Next question is, if the filibuster is abolished for the Gorsuch nomination, is the filibuster for all legislation next? And what impact would this have on our issues? It's a very good question. I don't think so. I think a filibuster on the Supreme Court is a little bit different. Last Congress, or maybe the Congress before, Senator Reid, the majority leader, did eliminate the filibuster on certain executive appointments. So this would seem to be the Republicans' tit for tat on the nuclear option, as it's called. I haven't heard anybody talking about eliminating the filibuster for all legislation. Certainly, as the Senate rules are changed and the precedent that sets, it's a possibility going forward that those could change. I do not think it's a likelihood, and it would have a huge impact on our issues. As right now, we're talking about threats through the budget resolution and reconciliation process, because that gets around the 60-vote threshold. We no longer have that specific procedural route to kind of only be worried about. It would be any piece of legislation we'd be worried about. Next question is, now that chapter membership is optional and we have lots of members that are not affiliated with chapters, what can we do not belong to chapters do to coordinate our efforts in the field? Just write letters. I think that's one of the things we'll have to be working on, and maybe as different federations set up congressional district liaisons, those are people to work with, getting in touch with local chapters to see if you can coordinate. You can email us, and we can see about putting you in touch if you're interested in getting involved with other NARF members locally. Next question is, what expected changes could happen to retirees' health and life insurance? Well, I had talked in the webinar about potential changes in FEHBP that could force you to pay more, a higher percentage of the premium. We're going to be fighting that very strongly. Life insurance, I don't foresee any changes in the near future. Next up, what steps are you aware of that OPM is trying to hold premium costs down? I think they are, in large part, they have to follow, their they're subject to the health insurance costs that are out there in the market. We have a few proposals in terms of what they can do to, you know, things that could lower the cost of prescription drugs by integrating with Medicare Part D in the right way, not at an additional cost to enrollees. You know, they negotiate with all the FHBB plans, and they send out a contract letter on that. One of the things they do is try to encourage more Medicare integration. You know, I'll be going to an advisory group meeting on Wednesday to see what some new things they're doing on that. Next question is, if this bill is passed, what is your best estimate of timing in which postal retirees who did not elect Medicare would be required to enroll in Medicare? Do you believe it would coincide with open season? Also, is the no penalty for not enrolling in Medicare when eligible eliminated in this scenario? Yes, the penalty would be waived for enrolling late. We've certainly pushed for that. The other thing is, yes, it would likely coincide with an open season and start at the beginning of the year. It would depend on when the bill passed, but I would say it would be at least a year after the bill passes, if not two or three. Next question is, what evidence do you have that customizing the sample letters you prepare have any more impact? I have never seen such. Well, there's some, at least, National Journal, which focuses on political research, has done surveys of members of Congress and their staff in which they ask people, what is most effective. You know, a personalized letter gets higher marks than a form letter. Question is, repeat the life insurance benefit changes. I do not see any changes on life insurance in the near future. There's a membership question I don't know the numbers to. I'm going to skip. There's a few questions that people left. I'll skip those as well. Next one is, regarding the TSPG fund, the CSRS offset employees, retirees do not receive matching funds. Would this change be inclusive for all employees? Yeah, any changes on the G fund rate of return would be for everybody that has their funds in the G fund. Next question is, if the TSP G fund is reduced, will the I funds be changed to exclude the G fund? I think it's the life cycle funds, not the I funds. Yes, we would hope they would be. Honestly, we would hope they would just stop offering the G fund because the rate of return is nothing. The question is, did you say that the government contribution for FHBP would be tied to inflation rather than the increase in premiums? Yes. It would be tied to the rise in the price of consumer goods generally, not in the rise of the cost of healthcare. The rise in the cost of healthcare is increasing at a greater rate, and that would cause you to pay more for your health insurance premiums. That is if that proposal from the previous budget resolution becomes law. A text version of this webinar to include the questions and answers be available online. Text version. We will have the slides and a recording online with the questions. We have been looking into some type of transcribed service for this as well. I'm not sure if we'll have it available for this webinar yet. The questions aren't written out. Next question is, Walton Francis has been a vocal critic of the current proposal to require Medicare for postal retirees. He has also proposed alternate changes to FHBP that he says have greater economic benefit than the current proposed scheme. Are you aware of his alternative proposed changes, and if so, what do you think of them? Yeah, so Walt Francis has been an expert on FEHPP. He used to work for the Office of Management and Budget. He puts out a checkbook on FEHPP plans. We have been in contact with him at various times on this postal. He's been putting stuff out for the Heritage Foundation on it. His proposal, I have seen his alternative proposal for it. There are potentially aspects of it that we could support, but there are certainly aspects of it that we would not. His most recent proposal as an alternative would be to, and this would be through all federal employees through FHPP, is to offer a contribution to a health savings account that you would be able to use to pay for Medicare premiums if you got out of FEHPP and took a Medicare Advantage plan. We do not think this would be good for the stability of FEHPP. And it could cause some adverse selection problems in which those who are healthier would leave the FEHPP plan to take the Medicare Advantage plan. We think there's maybe other ways to encourage Medicare enrollment without forcing it, and better ways to integrate Medicare. But we're certainly open to talking to Walt Francis. And if you want to shoot me an email, shoot it to leg@narf.org, and they'll forward it to me, and I'll get back in touch with you. I can answer that question at greater length. It's probably more complicated of an answer than I can spend. I could probably spend 15 minutes on at least. So this bill has one question is, do most postal retirees already enroll in Medicare Part B? Yes, many do. It's the segment who don't, who've chosen not to for various reasons, because they do not think it works for them with their health plan. The next question is, our rep calls for a bill that he wants. I think the question is referring to, there is a bill by Congressman Daryl Issa, which would open up FHPP to everybody in the country. Past versions of this bill have had a separate risk pool, in which case we have been fine with it. This most recent version of the bill would not have a separate risk pool, so it would open up FHPP to everybody in the individual markets. They tend to have higher health care costs than the federal employee group, and they could increase FHPP premiums if it's integrated. So we certainly do not support that in this way. We don't think FEHPP as an employer-sponsored plan should be combined with the individual marketplaces. It doesn't really work. Next question is, the question of reducing unions within the federal government been raised, and how would this change take place? There hasn't been a question on this webinar about reducing unions within the federal government. There have been efforts in Congress to eliminate or reform in a way that eliminates official time, which is an attack on the federal unions. The most recent iteration has been to prevent use of official time to count towards retirement benefit credits. It would also go back retroactively. So we've certainly been in touch with our federal union counterparts on some of those issues. They are more out front on those issues than we are. But there hasn't been anything that would outright eliminate federal unions at this time. Question is, how does making people go on Medicare Part B lower costs to the government? Wouldn't people still have FEHPP? Yes, people would still have FEHPP. But if you have coverage through FEHPP and Medicare, whether it's Part A or Part B, and you, let's say, go to the doctor, and that doctor's visit, let's just say it costs $1,000, there's a procedure you do there, Medicare is going to pick up that $1,000 first, and they might have a copay, so it might cost you $200, and that's where your FHVP plan might step in and pay $200. But if you only have FHVP, then they have to pick up that full $1,000 of coverage. So by having Medicare and FHVP, it lowers costs to FHVP, and because the government picks up a large share of your costs in FHVP, it lowers costs to the government. Next question is, NARF concerned about the low number of nominations to critical government positions in agencies such as state, energy, etc. Washington Post is tracking them, and it appears scary to me. We haven't focused on that as of yet. We certainly support good government and good government functioning with the staff necessary to operate agencies. I think there's been some, we have certainly heard problems with getting people applying for certain jobs. I don't think the transition has gone too quickly to fill all the posts that are necessary to be filled. Something we'll continue to monitor. Next question is, can you give us an example of how the government contribution works, inflation versus premium increase? An example of how the government, so I'll do that. So let's say your healthcare premiums are $2,000 a year, just used a round number, and right now the government pays half. It's not true, they pay 72% on average. So you pay $1,000 in premiums per month. If this FHVP proposal went through, not per month, per year, but I'm just using round numbers, these aren't real. If, let's say, inflation increased, your healthcare premiums the next year were to go up by $500, yet consumer goods only went up about $100, then the government contribution, you'd be paying that extra $400 difference between the two. So, you know, the difference is not so big, but you know, inflation has been below its historical average recently. Certainly, those who are monitoring for their cost of living adjustments have noticed this. But healthcare inflation has still been going up, even if at slower rates than earlier in this century. It has been going up at, you know, 4%, 5%, 6% a year, as opposed to, let's say, 1% or 2% a year. And that difference adds up quickly over time. And over 10 years, it really adds up to a lot. Next question is, if a change to the rate of return on the TSPG fund is approved, will it be immediate? I do not believe it will be immediate. Hopefully it will not be approved. The question is NARF aware that retirees can initiate a trustee-to-trustee transfer out of TSP to major investment companies? I'm not an expert on the rolling over of TSP funds to IRAs, so I can't answer that question. I am sorry. How do we protect the G fund at this time, pending legislation or other items to track? Right now, just keep an eye on things we're coming out of the NARF legislative department, whether it's a magazine or the hotline. If that gets put into a budget resolution again, we will be sure to let you know. Question, has NARF ever looked at contractor costs compared to feds to get the jobs done? You know, there's actually not very good accounting of all contractor costs. There was actually earlier in the year, there was a pretty good article by the Washington Post on how certain things at the Pentagon aren't really well accounted for, and contractor costs are one of those. There are different contractor to government employee processes for which one you do. We don't have an extensive analysis of it, but we certainly think that a lot of times you can cost a lot more money to contract out. Next question. The financial cornerstone of the postal reform bill is the $16.8 billion that would come from healthcare reform. The data I have seen does not support anywhere near that level of savings. Have you seen any data that supports the savings being advocated by postal management? So the Congressional Budget Office scored last year's postal reform bill, and it's not the $16.8 billion figure. It's a $7.8 billion figure in savings from Medicare that saves money for the Postal Service. There's other provisions of the bill that create savings in that, but I'm not going to get into that level of detail, but there's a CBO report on it. Next question is about the FERS annuity supplement. Is anybody getting rid of it? There have been proposals that's been part of the $318 billion worth of cuts. We do not think it would be done for current employees, but there have been proposals that would do that. So that's certainly on the table. Next question is, should retirees covered under TRICARE health insurance be concerned about any legislative changes at this time? I don't think so, but I do not know. We mainly focus on federal employee health benefit insurance, certainly supportive of military retirees and their families having adequate insurance and good insurance through TRICARE as well. But we kind of leave that to the military organizations to focus on. I have not been aware of any proposed changes on TRICARE recently. Next question, is there any chance that the requirement for current postal retirees to enroll in Medicare can be removed from the bill? I think very unlikely that it gets completely removed. Some amendment, though, we're very hopeful that we could get the bill amended to change that provision. I don't know if I'm just being optimistic or just that's what we're pushing for. And if not, then we hope the bill does not move forward. Next question, any bills this session on premium conversion? I do not think so. Next question, did I hear you correctly that there would likely be no future change in current retirees' pensions, but there could be an increase in current retirees' FEHBP premiums? Yes. Out of the current proposals that we've seen recently, yes. There's a question on the waiver of late enrollment penalty under the postal reform bill. As written right now, there would be a waiver of any late enrollment penalty for postal retirees forced into coverage. Question about percentage of employees and retirees members of NARF. I don't know the exact numbers. I think actives may be 15% at this point. Questions on waiver of late enrollment fee for postal retirees. Again, it would be waived. This is a good question. If HR 756, the postal reform bill passes, would each retiree have to apply for Part B separately, or could there be some sort of group enrollment? We actually pushed for this on the bill, that if postal retirees are required to enroll in Medicare, they would be automatically enrolled under the provisions of the bill as written now. It's something we've actually pushed for. We were really concerned that there would be somebody who, was not aware of this requirement and they would be required to enroll or lose their health insurance. They don't enroll because they don't know about it. All of a sudden they have zero health insurance and that would be a pretty bad situation. So yes, there would be automatic enrollment. Next question, are email letters directly to a member of Congress, a site likely to carry any more weight than one sent through the Legislative Action Center? I don't know that there would be a big difference. It's a lot easier to send one through the Legislative Action Center if you want to we can track it and see if we're sending letters that way. So it's helpful. So I would encourage the Legislative Action Center, but if you want to send it through their site, you can do that too. Question is, the government is currently using the G Fund for budget purposes, or I think to prevent the Treasury is using it for the government to prevent the government from defaulting on its debt. Why would they reduce the amount for this account? I think that's a good question, and I don't know why. I think, you know, the government is a unified entity. There are different members of Congress who make up the legislative branch and different members of the executive branch and the president. So we certainly think it's a bad idea. I think for those who like using the debt ceiling as a way to try to extract concessions and reductions in government spending, maybe it's a good thing that they get rid of the G Fund, which is basically used to prevent the government from defaulting. Next question is, paying for Medicare Part B from my federal annuity is much higher than paying for a Social Security benefit. I think GPO would help me. I don't understand the whole question, but I think the comment is that, yes, we do think it's unfair that if you pay Medicare Part B from Social Security benefit, you would be held harmless, but not if you pay from a CSRS annuity. That is not something we consider fair. And we've worked to try to prevent that disparity. Another question, what about those who are paying greater part of our Medicare premium increases because we're not eligible for Social Security? Well, if you're a postal retiree, you would still be forced into Medicare and still be forced to pay those higher premiums. And the same goes for if you are a higher income earner. Another reason why people might not want to pay for the Medicare Part B premium increases when they're paying an unfairly higher amount. So yes, postal retirees would pay the amount if it's from their CSR. It's based on whether your Part B premium is based on a couple things. One, your income. You might pay higher premiums if you have a higher income. Two, when there is no or low COLA, some people are protected if they have it coming from a Social Security benefit, such that your Social Security benefit would not decrease. But others, such as CSRS annuitants, are not protected. The postal bill would not change that dynamic, so some people would pay more. We're done. We're almost done now. Comment on putting the video on for the questions. We have done that in the past, and I guess we didn't do that now. It's fine. The next question, would an increase in FHPP result in a substantial COLA increase to offset the cost? No, that would be unlikely because the FHPP increase would only count towards you. COLAs are based on the survey of the general population. If you were just getting the additional cost, it would be reflected in the for the general population as well. Hey, I'm here. For those who are still watching, keep on going now. Next question is, if you have mailed a personal letter to your congressman, how do you follow up for a response and how long after sending? Personal letters sometimes take a little bit longer to get to your member of Congress. That is because they have to go through anthrax screening. But maybe if you don't get a response in a month, you can follow up with a phone call. They should give you a response. Next question. We only have a couple more left. How would postal FHPP plans change if HR 756 is passed? The bill seems to indicate that there would be a postal-specific FHPP plan. For example, would my current Blue Cross Blue Shield coverage change based on specific risk pool and Medicare integration? The way the postal bill is designed is that if you are in Blue Cross Blue Shield, for example, you would have a Blue Cross Blue Shield coverage. The value of that coverage should be the same as it was in the federal plan. The premiums would be different, and the premiums would likely go down a little bit to account for the fact that Medicare is picking up more of the costs. So there's that. The next question is, would disabled postal annuitants also have to enroll Medicare, even if not at retirement age? I think the bill is written to say Medicare eligible. I would have to double check on whether that would apply to disabled postal annuitants and not just those that are at retirement at 65 or over. Please feel free to follow up with a question. I could look at that, those specifics, but I don't know off the top of my head. All right. Well, I think that's it. Thank you all for joining, and I hope this was informative. I really appreciate it, and I will see you all later. Oh, I have a little screen thing. Thanks for joining. This PowerPoint and a video of the presentation will be available on NARF's website later this week. If you have any questions or feedback on today's webinar or next steps, please do not hesitate to contact the Legislative Department. Thank you.